You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I'm delighted to welcome my good friend and colleague, Scott Klisoski. Scott is a technologist, a futurist. He speaks globally on technology and the future of technology in our world. He's an author of multiple books, and he's the founder of a company called The Future Point of View. Scott is recognized globally for his unique ability to accurately predict future digital trends and provide the logic behind why they will alter the current status quo. I love having conversations with Scott about technology and how our lives are transforming, how we can leverage technology, and there's so much opportunity in behavioral health to do so. Today's episode is going to focus on a global perspective, kind of a high-level view on how technology is changing our world and how it specifically is changing behavioral health. Scott, welcome to the program.
I'm thrilled to be here, Roni.
So, we come from different worlds. I'm a behavioral scientist. My focus is on behavior intervention, studying, understanding, and changing behavior in people, right, to improve lives. You come from the technology world. You're a really great technologist and futurist. And so I'm wondering, as a technologist, how do you feel when you interact with the healthcare space?
Well, I'll give you two parts to that. First of all, you and I do come from different backgrounds. Yours is more humanist, right? And mine's more technology. But I think, as you know, I'm fascinated by the integration of humans and technology. So I'm fascinated by the intersection of the two of those. So yes, I study AI and I study machine learning and I study, you know, RPA. I mean, I study all kinds of technologies and I play out where are they going to go. There's a huge part of that, though, that is studying the interaction of human beings and technology, and where is that positive and where is that not positive, and what does that look like in the future? So, my mom was a therapist. I mean, I was raised to be half humanist, half technologist. So that is the cool thing about you and I. Anytime we talk, right, is I love what you do and where you come from. And I can easily weave it into what I see and, you know, what I hope for the world. So that's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer, when I interact with the healthcare space, I generally experience frustration. Now, I have great respect for the healthcare space. And so I sure wouldn't want anybody to think I don't respect the healthcare space. But there are many, many facets of it as a technologist that frustrate me.
Can you give me a little bit of detail, maybe an experience you've had?
Well, I can tell you experiences I've had, and I can also just point out specifically the kinds of things that just drive me nuts, about the healthcare industry. You know, from an experience standpoint, one of the ones that always leaps to mind for me is my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. We go in, we meet with a surgeon. Surgeon, basically, the decision is made to do a double mastectomy. And so, you know, both of us are business people and deal a lot with technology. And so we said to the doctor and to the nurse, okay, we'd like some information, some data, right? Some information on how to get prepared for a surgery like this and how to recover from a surgery like this. And the doctor, I'm telling you exactly how this goes down. The doctor says, if you just ask me questions, I'll just give you answers. And we said, okay, but we have a bunch of questions. And when we leave here, we're going to have a bunch more. So it's not very efficient to just try to think we're going to call you, and ask you every time we have a question. Don't you have a PowerPoint that's like the 20 things you need to know about mastectomies? You do a lot of them. Certainly you have a PDF or a you have a document. Right. That here's everything you need to know about what's going to happen and then everything you need to know about how to recover. Right. I mean, in the world I'm in, if you provide a service, you've got some documentation for people about what is the service that you're providing. And the doctor says, no, we don't have any of that. So we said, OK, no problem. We'll go out on the Internet and we will read. Right. We're good at that. We'll search and we'll read. And the doctor says to us, oh, no, don't do that. You can't trust what you read on the Internet. And so I looked at him and the nurse and I said, so you're not going to answer our questions and give us information, and you don't want us to go get information from anyone else. So what you want us to do is just have no information about this major surgery. And he said, well, I told you I would answer your questions. And that's how the conversation went. Now, you know, I've been around and there's been other surgeries and things like that. I'm just giving you one example. So one of my frustrations is the healthcare community, I don't think, has learned to deal with the fact that we have an internet that has a huge amount of information on it, and that we are now able to learn about something without just taking a healthcare professional's advice on it. So for years and years, if I went into a doctor and I had a sore throat, they would swab my throat. They'd say, you have strep throat and here's a prescription. And I would just go, okay. I mean, that's what I did when I was 18, 19 years old. Whatever you told me, I was like, okay. And I just did it. That time is gone. So, you know, now we have a need to know, to get a second and third opinion. You know, we're taking more responsibility for our healthcare. And I don't care if it's a parent that has an autistic child, you know, or a woman that's got breast cancer, or my knee starts to hurt, right? We're taking more responsibility for the outcome, and we should. I am incredibly frustrated when I interface with the industry and they won't share information with me. And let's dig down. They often tell me, well, it's malpractice. If we were to actually share information with you and then later you felt like any of it was incorrect, you might sue us for malpractice. So we're just not going to tell you anything, because we don't want to create liability. Like, you got to be kidding me. So that's one personal experience. I will tell you another one that bothered me maybe more than that. I'm working with a board of directors for an association, and they're all doctors. And we were talking about data. And I said, you all write prescriptions. When you write prescriptions, do you follow up with your patients to find out how well the prescription worked? And they said, oh, absolutely not. And I said, I have no understanding of that. Like, from a practical, if I wrote a prescription for somebody, I would want to know a week or later, you know, a week or two later, did it work for you? Did it make you sick to your stomach? You know, did it make you lightheaded? But did it work? Because I don't want to write prescriptions and hand out medicines if it's not working for people. So I would want feedback. I would want data on the outcome or the results. And I told him that. I said, I think you're being irresponsible because you write prescriptions for heavy-duty drugs and you do no polling, you do no work to find out if they work or don't work. They were angry with me, Renee, angry with me, because I said that they should do follow-up work to gather data. And to this day, I do not understand this thinking. And I don't want to be negative and say, well, maybe you're just pushing the drugs that the drug companies tell you you should push. I mean, I don't know what the reason is, but if I cared about my patients, I would not write a prescription and then not talk to them again unless, you know, or just assume that they got better. I would want to know every time. I would have a nurse or I'd have somebody calling and saying, hey, it's been a week. Did you get the prescription filled? Yes or no? Because I want that data. How many people are filling them? Did you take all of it? Right? Because I want to know that data. And when you took it, did you have any reaction or did it work? And if they said, no, I had a reaction, it made my stomach hurt. Okay, did you eat? Did you drink something? Like, it isn't hard, right, to gather the data so that I would know whether writing this prescription for the next patient is a good idea or a bad idea.
I guess they work not by exception, but if it doesn't work, right, they assume they're going to hear from the patient if it doesn't work.
Yes, I think that's true, you know. But they know that not every patient that it doesn't work for is going to get back in touch and tell them.
Right.
You know, at least half of the patients will get sick, not take the rest of it, or not never even fill the script. You know, I mean, there's so much they don't know, and they don't even care to know. And by the way, after that meeting, they never did business with me again. That is a true story. I think they felt like I was a interesting guy with my thoughts about data and how the healthcare industry should use data. But it really offended them when I used them as an example of that the healthcare industry doesn't gather data well on outcomes or, you know, performance of what they're recommending. And that honestly, the truth is they don't want to know.
Right.
If they wanted to know, they would gather it. They don't want to know.
So the first thing that comes to mind for me is what we see a lot with kids with attention deficit disorder, right? They get a daily prescription of Ritalin or something like that to help manage their concentration. And what you see often is parents will give it to them Monday through Friday, and then they don't give it to them on weekends. And so, you know, you have a significant change in behavior of the weekend, and then Monday, Tuesday, the child's readjusting to the medication. And those data aren't collected, right? I'm sure there would be a lot of information gleaned on how this medication's working, how it's not working, and just parent compliance, because we see that all the time. They take the kids off the medication during the summer.
Yeah, I was at a party the other day, and there was a little girl, a beautiful little girl, that was struggling with a form of cancer. And she was on a cocktail, and it was working well. And she had to take the cocktail every day, but the cocktail, you know, did make her sleepy. It had some impact. And she was, her mother gave her the cocktail religiously, but the father had the little girl and was going to a birthday party, and he didn't give it to her on purpose. And then, you know, by the end of the day, you know, she had diarrhea. She was, you know, getting sick because, you know, you can't take her on and off that, you know, she needs to have it regularly. I see things like that all the time. And it's like, no, I don't think we do a strong enough job of studying what are people doing with the recommendations doctors make, and what kind of follow-up are we doing? And some of that is parents' fault, right? I mean, if the parents are not giving the Ritalin on weekends, it's parents' fault, but it's the healthcare industry's fault if you're not doing the research to find out how often that's happening, or that people are doing it and they're doing it unknowledgeably.
So how's technology going to change healthcare? I mean, an example would be a wearable that a child has that actually signals somebody, the parent, the doctor, your child hasn't had their medication today. I mean, I think of things like that. But how, you know, on a higher level, how's technology going to change healthcare? Or how is it?
Well, first of all, you brought up a wonderful example, which is we now, but way more in the future, we'll be able to have a wearable that somebody has that takes 30 different healthcare signs from them. And when we have that, it will completely reverse medicine, where we really will get to preventative medicine. Because today we have the model of you get sick, you go in, I write you a prescription and try to make you well, you know, or I give you advice and try to make you well. When you have a device that will grab 30 different, you know, healthcare signs from you, now what you can do is contract with a doctor to have their AI watch over all your data. And the doctor will call you and say, Ronit, your temperature's up 1 degree. We've noticed you're a little bit dehydrated. The CDC says there's a high amount of flu in your area. We have a Tamiflu prescription for you if you want to okay it, you know, and it'll all be proactive. You know, why? Because their AI is watching over your data. Not a doctor, because there's no way a doctor is going to watch over your data in real time times 100 patients, right? So it'll be the doctor's AI that when you subscribe to the doctor, which we don't do today, we go in when we're sick, right? But we in the future, we'll subscribe to a doctor, and then the doctor will be able to watch over and monitor our data and then proactively interface with us, right, to give us advice. In other words, you know, move us way more towards preventative. I mean, I would add what you said about a wearable to a AI that sits over the top of it and does some amazing things. But there, your question was, how will technology, you know, help healthcare? There's a couple of other good answers. You know, AI in general will be able to co-work with a doctor to lower dramatically the error rate of diagnosis and prescription. Because I don't want to say an AI just replaces a doctor, but AIs, for instance, today we know AIs can diagnose x-rays, right, or look at x-rays and see things humans can't see. But what I want is a combination of a radiologist and an AI, right, a co-working, you know, what we call a co-working radiologist, because that is the best case scenario now. Now, someday maybe I just want the AI to read my x-ray. But right now what I want is an AI that's reading and seeing things that they can't see, alerting them to what the AI saw, and then the radiologist helps to diagnose that for me, right? So I think the AIs in healthcare will be a dramatic change, just, you know, helping doctors to be able to make much better diagnosis. And then, you know, obviously remote care, you know, we've seen that a little bit through COVID, but it's just the tip of the iceberg of let's break down this model of you have to drive into a doctor's office to be checked up. You know, I mean, let's use the model. I can stay at home and not carry my sickness around the city, you know, and still get a diagnosis and still get a prescription. You know, so some things like that. Certainly when you've got smart devices and the home has a smart thermometer, right? The home's got a smart blood analyzer, a smart urine analyzer, you know, then if you don't feel well, you know, you can do your own analysis and send all that data to the doctor instead of going in. You know, all those things we are starting to have now. So I'm excited about everything we just talked about.
I'm sure you're familiar with Invisalign, right? Where you get the aligner trays and you change them. So now they have a scanner box that you take home with you. And every 7 days you scan your teeth with this device that connects to your cell phone. And then the AI reads it and says, it's time to change or wear it for 2 more days. You know, your hygiene looks good. Your brushing doesn't look so good. And so the AI is already, you know, whereas people were typically only changing trays every 2 weeks. Now you can speed up your orthodontia significantly because you may be ready to change 7 days with one set of trays and 9 days with the next set of trays.
Yeah. It just, you know, the thought of smart healthcare devices, you know, that we reduce the size of a thermal imaging or a MRI, you know, to a handheld device and it's internet connected, you know, and if I tell the doctor my knee hurts, the doctor says, all right, well, go ahead and scan your knee for me, you know, and I just scan the scanner over my knee and he looks at the results and says, you know, it sure looks to me like you might have a torn MCL. You know, that stuff's not science fiction. You know, it's not that hard to me and it's not that far away. Just like I said, a smart thermometer. I mean, we have electronic thermometers now, right? And now when I walk into some buildings, they shoot my temperature, right? Well, those will just get more and more accurate, internet connected. You know, we'll be able to saliva analysis, you know, as they're getting better and better at doing tests just off of saliva, you know, then you don't need to do a test strip at a doctor's office anymore, right? It's just you have a electronic device and you just lick it and, you know, it sends all the results immediately to a doctor who analyzes them for you, you know? And then the next step after that is you have an AI that just does the analysis for you. Right. So you just sign up with WebMD and WebMD does all your blood work or your saliva work or your urine work. And, you know, you just send the data to them and they crunch that data and come back to you with what their analysis is. It's not even a hospital or a doctor anymore.
So how's technology going to change how I do business as a service provider? If I'm providing home health services or, you know, senior care or, you know, direct services to kids with autism or disabilities or traumatic brain injury, how's technology going to change how I do business?
Well, let's look at it in categories. One is technology is going to give you a better ability to build relationships with patients, right? To find patients or to have patients or people with service needs find you. So technology can really help you to quote unquote advertise yourself out into the market instead of you have to be in a medical arts building, you know, or you have to have a Yellow Pages ad or you have to have recommendations from a GP. You know, you're going to have more and more of an ability, you know, to market and advertise your own unique capabilities online and have people find you. You know, so that's one thing, finding people. Technology will help you build better relationships with your, let's call them customers, right? Instead of patients, right? With your customers, because whether that's somebody you're helping or the family of who you're helping, technology is going to allow you to build a much better, tighter, more meaningful relationship with them without you driving there to see them all the time. Yes, you still need to drive there and see them, maybe especially when you do an intake. But, you know, obviously with video and collaboration tools with all the things COVID has brought to us, it's going to be a lot easier to use technology now to build a more meaningful relationship with people. Then another category is going to be gathering data. So we were talking about wearables, you know, the more sensors, the more smart devices, the more wearables we have, the more you're going to be able to gather real-time data on the behavior of somebody or their physical manifestation. So you'll get much better data, because today, I would guess what would cripple you almost the most is a lack of data on who you're trying to help. Because when they have an episode, you weren't around to see what they were doing, what the conditions were, you know, what their physical, you know, manifestation was before the episode kicked in. Now all you can do is forensics. All you can do is say, well, did they eat sugar? I mean, were they dehydrated? Were they watching television? Right? You have to do all the forensics on a behavioral episode, as opposed to you have a lot of devices that you're pulling information from. And not only can you look at all the devices to see what was going on before the episode happened, you can start to prevent them, right? You can start to say, hey, I'm starting to see these signals. You know, you better change something or we're going to have a problem. So I think that happens as you be able to acquire way more data to be able to work with somebody to have a better outcome. I think that you're going to have a better ability to pull in data from other sources, right, and get visibility to what some of the best practices are or what people are doing around the country that's working faster than what we've had in the past. I think it's a real shame. Like right now, it's not a behavioral thing, but you probably heard the story. There's a guy who is a surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, who is also an engineering degree, a young doctor. He got an engineering degree and he's an orthopedic surgeon. And he mixed those two things together to figure out how to do artificial knee replacement in a new way. And I saw how he does it. It's really cool. And the way that he does it, people are literally recovering back up pretty ambulatory within 3 days. The sad thing is, it's like, I swear to you, 80% of doctors that do knee replacements in the country probably don't know about this guy and what he does. And I think that's a shame. And I think that's the last piece of the puzzle I think that technology will help with, is I think we're going to get better and better and better at being able to see best practices and know best practices, so that we're not just using our own knowledge or our own enlightenment without being able to tap in much faster, better to everybody else's enlightenment as well. So those would be the categories for me.
What about the management of employees if you have a huge workforce?
Wow. Well, this year's been an interesting year because we've been forced into distributed workforces. You know, we could say work from home, but I'll just say a distributed workforce. So, and we've been forced into it and then found out it works pretty well. You know, in some cases, it's better than people all coming to an office. I mean, better because the productivity is higher, better because it's not polluting the environment, right? Better for a lot of reasons. On the other hand, there's also issues with work from home. Like, how do you establish a culture and how do you hold people accountable? And right. So we're learning a lot about distributed work. And so when you talk about managing a team, I do a lot of work in the HR field, the crossover of HR and technology. And so, man, there's a lot of potential right now for HR people to, again, build much tighter relationships with employees, to really monitor performance at a higher level, provide real-time mentoring. There's a lot of pretty cool stuff on the horizon that technology is going to allow. We were just doing some work yesterday on career customization. So being able to talk to a team member and literally architect, how do you want your career to look? You know, how long do you want to work? How much money do you want to make? You know, where do you want to work? What skills do you want to learn? How do you want to be upskilled? What is your goal? Do you want to be on a leadership track or not on a leadership track? Do you want mentoring in specific areas? Do you not want mentoring? And literally by team member. Right, create a completely different, customized model for how you work with the company, and using technology to empower a lot of it. So I think there's a lot of room for technology to help with how we manage. Now, I could also tell you, like specifically with nursing, we're starting to see technology being used to allow nurses to work across organizations in a much better way. So instead of just having to work for one, and either they're too busy or not busy enough, you know, allowing sharing across organizations and where it is all managed centrally by a piece of software, is so that it's better for the practitioner, the nurses, and it's also better for the hospitals or medical centers. It spreads their work out more evenly and helps the nurses more evenly. And it's all done with technology, right? So there's some really interesting things out there that I'm pretty excited about how technology will help healthcare to manage resources, because today that's a problem, as you know.
That's really helpful, a lot of food for thought. Let's talk about data, because I think this year, certainly we've been overwhelmed with data. I feel overwhelmed, and I'm not really sure what to believe, what not to believe, you know, especially around COVID. What are the real numbers? Now you read that all the positives should actually be negatives, or there are too many false positives or false negatives. How do you feel about data? Because it's so important in my industry, which we'll talk about in the future, but on a general level.
On a general level, let me address the pandemic and the information from the pandemic. It is the worst I've ever seen in my lifetime, being straight with you. You know, I'm a data person, and I have never seen such poor and conflicting data on anything in my life as what I've seen in the last 6-8 months. It is mind-numbing. And I mean everything from we aren't getting the truth from the Chinese at all, right? So, I mean, so a total lack of data, which would have been helpful, to absolutely conflicting data, you know, about almost everything. You know, how do you get it? Oh, it's airborne, or you get it off of a surface. You know, if it's airborne, how far does it travel? How long can it stay alive? If you get, you know, how accurate are the tests? How many people are being tested? You know, how many tests are positive? There isn't really any one piece of data that I look at that I could go, oh, you know, that's something I can depend on. You know, I've listened to a lot of data scientists, and I was listening to a great one out of Europe. And he was talking about the fact that he totally ignores positive tests. He said, I just ignore them as a data point because I don't trust the tests, and I don't even trust that the positives are being counted right. So he said he basically looks at deaths, you know, at deaths and like hospital admitting, and that's it. Because he said, like, that's something that is real that I can ground. But he said, then, you know, even the problem with deaths is when you give hospitals an incentive to get paid for somebody who is claimed as a COVID death, well, then everyone gets claimed as a COVID death. Well, now you can't even believe that the deaths are accurate, right? So it's a long way to say that I've never seen such poor data and information in my life. I also say I'm an optimist that after this horrible experience we're going to have with this pandemic, I think the next one will be better, because I think a lot of organizations, CDC, you know, WHO, states, cities, I think they will all buckle down and go, okay, that was awful. I mean, that was awful. And we're not going to go through that again. So from now on, you know, when we give out information on who's been tested and positives, we're also going to give out how many tests were done. And, you know, I mean, we're going to make sure people get the right analytics from now on, because this was terrible. So I think it'll get better, but it was awful. If we just generalize for a second, data and healthcare, I already shared with you that I believe that the healthcare system does a really poor job of tracking outcomes. I'm not saying they don't do it, because they do in some cases. I'm just saying overall, the tracking of outcomes and the analytics of why did an outcome happen or not happen is really not done well. And I think that's a problem. But I think even gathering data, let's talk about something at a basic level. If I go to the doctor today and I say, I'm concerned about my breathing, okay? I'm concerned about my breathing and I'd like you to do something. This is how it goes down. I want you to give me your past history. So tell me, you know, anything that's gone wrong with you in the past. First of all, you have no idea if what I'm saying is accurate right now, right? So, but let's just assume that what I say is accurate. You're asking me a standard set of questions, right? Just a standard set of questions. And then you're going to run some tests, and then you're going to give me advice. I would argue that there are about 20 really critical questions that you will never ask me. You will never ask me a lot of times questions like, You know, Scott, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your breathing problems today? And how would you rate where you were a year ago or 5 years ago? Do you believe there's anything that's causing it? Like, do you believe that there's anything that is causing it? Can you tell me if it happens when you're in this city versus another city? Does it happen under a heavy load of activity or no activity? You know, when do you find this the most? Do you have these breathing problems when you are under stress? Like, there's so many questions you could ask, which would lead you to possible outcomes, but you don't. You give me a checklist, and it's the same checklist for everybody. You know, well, I'm a data guy. I'm like, really? So I'm going to pay you a lot of money to give me your expert, you know, opinion. And you're not even going to ask me questions that would seem to be very basic and reasonable questions. And again, if I'm cold, what I'm going to say is you don't really care. You don't care that much. You're going to get paid whatever you're going to get paid if I check off all your boxes on your form. And if you run some tests and then you get me out of there and give me some advice, you're going to get paid the same. So why would you take the time to ask me 10 or 20 more questions? So I don't know. I have real issues around data and the healthcare space because I don't think they use data to be as effective as they should. They don't use data the way a company would use data. They just don't. I mean, a consumer products company gathers way more data on a customer than a doctor does. And that's sad. You know, Lululemon probably gathers more data on me and what pants I bought at Lululemon than that doctor did, you know, when I said, you know, I'm having some breathing problems. And that's sad.
So Scott, while you were talking there, I was thinking for an optimist, this is a pretty dark, pessimistic viewpoint on data and where we stand today. Where's the optimism?
Yeah, good point. Good point. Because it is true that I am an optimist. And I think what I would say is this is a maturity thing, Roni. It's just, you know, we're at a little bit of a level of immaturity with data. Honestly, we're still at a level of immaturity with digital transformation, you know. And so when I sound dark or when I sound pessimistic, it's more that I'm probably just describing the immaturity of where we are or immaturity of the healthcare system as far as, you know, where it is on the curve of adopting things. But man, I look out into the future and I think the healthcare industry is going to be able to do magical things, magical things. And I'm so excited about those magical things that on the other side of it, I'm frustrated what I have to deal with today, you know, when I go in. Just like, you know, you, everybody that is listening, you would relate to this. You know, what was it 5, 6 years ago? You'd walk into a doctor and they'd hand you 3 clipboards, right? 3 clipboards. And you'd have to fill out with a pen, right?
They still give you clipboards. A lot of places.
Yeah. And so I know it sounds frustrating when I say, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. You're giving me clipboards in 2020.
But it's even worse, Scott, because you go in a year later and they give you the same piece of paper and you're updating your information and you're starting from scratch on a clipboard. And I love, my favorite question is your date of birth still the same? I've had that a couple of times.
Yeah. And I know it can sound sometimes like I'm pessimistic or I'm, you know, I have a dark view on this. It's only that I'm frustrated that I know what it could be and I know what it will be. And so when we talk about what is the state of things today, I always express a high amount of frustration. You know, when I talk about where it's going to be in the future, I see magical things and I'm so excited. I'm so excited what my kids will have, right? And what my grandkids will have. And I'm just frustrated about what I have, you know, today. But I am so optimistic about what healthcare will look like and what it will be able to accomplish in 5, 10, 20 years from now. It's going to be so much better than it is today.
I think another interesting aspect is, you know, right now, certainly in the autism services industry, right, we provide services for a long time and insurance companies and payers are trying to figure out, like, what is that prescribed amount of time? And something, you know, I had a conversation this morning with somebody who was talking about, we're going to start looking at recidivism. You know, we're going to give you 6 months to work with or a year to work with somebody. And then we're going to stop and we're going to see, do they regress, right? Instead, you know, kind of the opposite on outcomes. Does this child regress? How many strategies did the parent actually learn and incorporate into their day? And so what do you think about recidivism data as kind of the other way of looking at, you know, looking at regression versus looking at progress?
Well, I guess the wording I would use is, I think it's okay to look at things as performance-based pay. Okay. I think that's okay. I think you have to be careful about how you judge performance. But if you go outside of the healthcare space, performance-based pay is a growing thing, you know, and that's, in some ways, that's an equality issue. You know, I want to pay women as the same as men. And I want to pay young people the same as older people. And I want to pay ethnic people the same as, you know, Caucasians. And the more I move to performance-based pay, I get rid of bias, right? I mean, I get rid of inequality. And so I love the concept. It doesn't work everywhere, but, you know, where you can do it, performance-based pay. So if I'm an insurer, you know, I think the issue for me is I want to make sure I'm tying a little bit of what I'm paying for to the performance. And whether that performance is judged by progress or regression or what the metrics, that's probably where the magic comes in, you know, or the reality comes in. But I'm all for, you know, performance-based pay, that if you're making progress with an autistic person, you know, then we should keep paying. And if your progress has stopped, we should evaluate. I'm not saying we should stop paying. I'm just saying we should evaluate, you know, hey, Ronit, it looked like we were making progress for 6 months, but now we're not. You know, we need to understand what you're doing, you know, to know whether we should continue to pay, you know, because are we providing any value at this point? You know, and then if another 6 months goes by and we're not getting any positive results, you know, as an insurance, you know, now you get an interesting question is it your fault? Should I keep paying, but there's a different provider? Right. And I'm going to ask the ultimate receiver of the service to change providers. Right. Or am I just going to end it and just say, I'm not paying anymore? Because I think, unfortunately, in some cases, the way we handle that is, oh, we're not making progress with the patient. We're not paying anymore, you know, funds out. Well, why are we not making progress? It could be the practitioner.
So I really want to drill down into that with you, you know, in future episodes, because there's so many factors. When we look at autism, you know, the adage, if you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child with autism. There's such a uniqueness to treating each person. And so I really want to, you know, chat with you about how do we, in a value-based care model, how do we assess all those factors, you know, actually account for them? And I think that's where data and AI is going to play into it.
Yeah, it's a complex topic, which means it's fun. Right. But it's a complex topic. And the only problem with complex topics is until we figure out how to deal with them eloquently, people are hurt. Right. They're hurt by the complexity, because when there's complexity, then insurance companies don't want to pay, or, you know, people don't know how to find the right practitioner, or practitioners don't know how to do the right, you know, activities. That's a problem with complexity. And you're right. A broken bone is not that hard. Right? We got one or two ways to fix it. Pick one. An autistic child, you're right. Every single one's unique and there's a lot of complexity. So yeah, I look forward to diving into talking about how technology might play a role in lowering that complexity level.
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
All right.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Ronit Mulco. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.